The office. Again, the next matter is McCracken versus Thomas Jackson Family Office. You may proceed.
Hello, in responding to any of your questions, I don't hear very well. Or maybe I just don't know the answer.
We'll try to speak loudly.
We're going to presume that you just don't hear us.
Good afternoon. My name is Rodney Vincent. I'm an attorney for the appellants. The focus of this appeal, in our opinion, is that our contention that the appellants, Michael and Sharon McCracken, are real persons of interest in this cause of action. And other subordinate issues are, did the district court err when it denied the request for a continuance so that we could better answer the motion for summary judgment? And should the district court's vague order regarding Mr. McCracken's affidavit be overruled? We believe there are real persons of interest based upon the contract of an investment advisory contract between Mr. McCracken, or the McCrackens, and Appellees Thomas Jackson and Thomas Jackson's family office. If you don't mind, I'll use Jackson office. Let's kind of shorten this down a little bit. And also the breach of the investment advisory contract between McCracken's and Appellee's Fifth Third. That's a whole conglomerate that we've been using, Fifth Third. As Mr. Jackson and Jackson office principals. We, and also upon the fraud upon the McCrackens by Mr. Jackson and the Jackson office and their principals. In connection with the solicitation of by Mr. Jackson, and his record shows he had been their representative with a line of banks, and at this time, he moved from a bank and registered investment advisor and became registered investment advisor representative. He then solicited the McCrackens to move to go with him. And in the contract, he represented that he would help them find a suitable advisor called a third-party administrator. He did disclose that he had a relationship with Fifth Third. He reported or represented that he would collect information from the appellants, send that information to the Fifth Third, and conduct reviews of the progress of the investments at Fifth Third. Well, the evidence before the district court demonstrates that they failed to do so, either for themselves or for as agents for Fifth Third.
Mr. Vincent, yes. I'm concerned you might run out of time before we get to the primary issue on which the court granted summary judgment, and that was the standing of your clients, yes, to bring this claim. Okay. And so if you wouldn't want to go to addressing that, I would appreciate it.
Okay, I will drop to the bottom of the page.
And so I take it from reading your brief, you don't really dispute that your clients didn't have standing as trustees or beneficiaries.
They do have standing as a contract, victims of fraud, victims of negligence.
But did you allege any damages that were just separate and individual to your clients?
Yes.
Or were your damages in your complaint really damages that allegedly occurred to the trust value?
Both. The third-party contract going forward, there was a recommendation that they surrender a life insurance policy, and that was outside the trust, and that, I believe, was $40,000 worth of surrender charge. I could be wrong on the dollar amount, but that was one act. The other act is that the appellants did have a reasonable expectation for, from the very beginning, that for a money from the trust for their life. And even after, and this was at $172,000 a year, which is less than they were being paid, but they were, the floor of what they were to be paid was $150,000 a year. Where it really comes down to it is in the change, the duties that Mr. Jackson and Jackson family and Fifth Third had to inform Mr. and Mrs. McCracken about what was going on. Now, they did send them monthly or quarterly statements, but they had hired these people to explain. Mr. McCracken is an engineer, travels around the country and does whatever engineers do, but is not financial. He hired these people to look after his money. He paid them. That's the contract. They didn't do it. As a result, and we know from the track record, that they could change trustees. In the brief, you see they changed several times. In fact, they fired for a third in early 2009. Had they been informed, they could have taken preventive action. What really hurt them the most was in 2007, 2008. By that time, they had changed the allocation within the trust from a 70%+ in debts, which do not go up and down to the stock market very much, to 70% equities, high risk equities. So when 2008 occurred, the fall of it, they lost 42% of the account over $1 million. And instead of
Mr. Vincent, when
the expectation to go to 2018...
When did your clients divest themselves of this interest in the trust?
They divested themselves this, in 2013.
And up until that time, had they received all of the annual payments they were to receive?
That is correct. They, in fact, the investment advisors never recommended that they lower it because they could have lowered it from $200,000 down to a lower figure to make it extend. That issue was never brought up to them. But that's not the point. They were paid every time, but there was nothing left. The reason they sold it was to avoid the tax consequences. Had the well not been dry, they would have continued holding it. Very simply, 2013 to 2018, 5 years, $200,000 a year, it's $1 million.
And they sold their interest for seven.
Pardon?
They sold their income interest for $700.
Right, I believe it's 2000.
Yeah, 2012 is what the record reflects for $760,000.
2012, actually.
Yeah, for $760,000. So is your argument the difference between $1 million and $760,000?
Well, yes. I don't really know why the buyer paid that particular amount, but they were due this money with expectation for the rest of their lives. Now, I think I've got to... Yeah, I got to jump to the failure on continuous. If I've close to answered your questions.
Thank you.
Close. All right. Failure to grant the continuance. Now, a apparent argument by the defendant at that time was we had not been diligent in discovery. And the fact this is the first time we'd asked for continuance is immaterial. But in fact, the case was filed in January 2013. The last answer was filed in March 18th. First discovery was April 24th, 2013. Fifth Third responded on June 7th. It was inadequate discovery, usual stonewall first time around. We sent a meet and confer letter on July 26th. No response was received. The plaintiff filed a motion to compel on August 29, 2013. We did finally get a fair number of documents. We had discovery in January. We got motions for summary judgment filed in April and May of 2014. And we didn't get the briefs in support, and then the motions had no basis, didn't say why, they just said motions. So I think I'm out of time, a full 10 minutes.
I'm going to need to ask you one question before you step back. The $200,000 that was due each year, how many years was the $200,000 paid?
I don't know for sure. But I can tell you that it was based on a projected 5.5% income.
I just want to know how much they received.
Yeah. I think it was first set up in 2002. And it was,
and they sold it in
my recollection.
So it would be 10 years?
It was sold in 2012.
So it was 10 years?
10 years.
Thank you very much.
Pardon me?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Brian Sullivan, on behalf of known as the Fifth Third Defendants. Split my time with my appellee. Take more than my share. Judge Moore, in answer to your question that you asked the appellant, there is no allegation. Plaintiff's pled in one of three positions. Income beneficiary as the trustor, the settlor, the people who created the trust, or on behalf of Children's Hospital. Pledged to be the remainder beneficiary. Judge Inbody, in answer to your question, the trust was created in 2000. They received $200,000 a year, mandated by Section 2.2 of the trust for every year until 2012. And they sold the trust.
So that'd be 11 years?
A little more than 11 years. It was created in January of 2000, and they sold it.
So how many payments were made?
Well, if it's $200,000 a year, half years.
So they made a $100,000 payment?
No, they got paid $200,000 per year from the trust.
Right.
They got that for 11 and a half years.
Okay. So that last half year, did it get paid?
Well, that's because they sold their interest.
Before or after when the payment was due?
After they sold. They got paid every dollar they were entitled to until they sold their interest. They were no longer income beneficiaries.
Thank you.
There's not a period of time where payment is missed.
So is it your contention that the argument about mismanagement or the damages resulting from the failure to properly invest or failure to properly advise goes to the value of the trust, which they no longer have standing to assert?
Exactly. They didn't have standing to begin with.
And there can be no argument that they were forced to sell and therefore lost future income by being forced to sell because the trust essentially collapsed?
Well, the answer is the trust did not collapse. But did they plead? The answer is they did not plead. Because remember, they didn't tell us it was filed. We sold the trust. But they pled the case and the complaint is, we are the income beneficiaries. We know that's not. We have Children's Hospital as the contingent remainder, charitable. We know that's not true. And then they sued Fifth Third, as we all know, was the third in a succession of five different trustees. The allegation is that Fifth Third, while it managed as a trustee from 2003 to 2009, somehow did not invest the assets of the trust properly, so that this ad infinitum payment of $200,000 would not be met sometime in the future. But the appellants just overlook two significant things. When the charitable remainder annuity trust is created, the McCrackens give up legal right to that money. They're not no longer owners of them. It becomes the ownership under the trust, and the trustee is charged with the obligation to maintain it and manage it. They created that document called the trust. They will not tell you that Article 8.2 of the trust gives the trustee extremely broad discretion and says the trustee shall, without liability, may, without liability, invest, not diversify, invest in particular assets. All of that is overlooked completely. But the real point here is when they thought something was amiss, their obligation as income beneficiary to go to the then current trustee, remember there were two trustees after Fifth Third, and say, we believe a claim ought to be made. The trustee has the only legal authority to bring the action. Krakens don't step into that until the trustee refuses, and then they can bring the action. There's no allegation.
They could have brought it while they were still income beneficiaries.
If they ask the trustee refuses, then they can bring and say, we've asked the trustee refuses, and now we want to make this allegation.
They make that effort in the motion for new trial? Is that
right,
my recollection?
They didn't even contact the Paul Beckner, who is the current trustee at the time the lawsuit was filed. They didn't even know who he was. Mm-hmm. McCracken's testified under oath, we don't know who he is or where he is. And then after summary judgment was granted, then they reach out to him and he says he doesn't want to be part of it.
But at that point, they're not income beneficiaries.
Right. They're already.
Thank you.
So, unfortunately for them, it's a simple argument. It boils down to a simple argument. Standing, we think the trial court was correct in her analysis.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Please, the court. My name is Robert Peterson, and I represent what's referred to here as the Jackson interest. A little history on this trust might be beneficial. This was created in 2000, and it's what was called a charitable remainder annuity trust. The McCrackens created this long before they met any parties here that's involved in this litigation. And when they create this charitable remainder trust, they transfer their assets to the trust. Once that happens, as we point out, courts have recognized that an individual grantor, when he does, places property in the trust, those assets belong to the trustee. The trustee is the legal owner of those assets. So when they did this back in 2000, the trust belonged to the trustee. The only thing that they had at that point in time was the annuity right of the $200,000 that came to them every year. And the trust mandated that. There was a specific provision that says that they get this $200,000, and it was paid quarterly. In answer to Your Honor's question about what they received, those payments were made $50,000 quarterly. So you put the math to it, they had somewhere around $2.3 million that they had received during the course of the trust. But most importantly, when you look at what that trust authorized them to retain, they only had the right to replace the office of trustee. If a trustee resigned, they couldn't force the trustee. And they could change the remainder beneficiary. Those are the only two rights that they had. The exclusive right to manage this trust then went to the trustee. And I don't want to recite all of the cases that we had in our brief, but they're uniform, and Nebraska courts have recognized that damages to the trust have to be brought by the trustee. There's only one circumstance. That is if they ask a trustee to bring that action, and the trustee refuses to do it, then they have the right to do it. there was never any allegation in the complaint that they did this. In fact, when I took Mr. McCracken's deposition, he didn't even know who the trustee was at the time that they filed this lawsuit. He had never talked to the trustee, had no idea how to get a hold of him. So that exception to them being able to bring the cause of action didn't apply because they had never asked for it. And just getting back to what the trial court went through, they had three separate allegations that they made. One, they brought it on behalf of the trust. Well, clearly, if you look at the cases that we have in our brief in the Slaughter Spicewood case, that cause of action belongs to the trustee. There were five trustees that handled this. Three of them, after Fifth Third was no longer a trustee, every trustee paid out the mandatory amount, and no trustee brought any action against Jackson or Fifth Third Bank. That action belonged to the trustee. The trial court also analyzed their allegation that they bought it as beneficiaries of the trust. They didn't have that right even before they sold that, their interest. But to compound that, in October of 2012, they sold every interest they had, which essentially was a right to receive the distribution. And so 3 months later, they file this complaint alleging they bring it on behalf of the trust, they bring it on behalf of themselves as beneficiaries. Well, the trial court correctly looked at that and said, you know, you don't have a right as beneficiaries.
And but isn't the whole argument, though, in McCracken's brief that the court didn't decide the issue of standing for them to pursue their claims on their own behalf?
No, I don't think that's accurate. I think the trial court, she analyzed all three of these, whether they had the right to bring it as beneficiaries.
Right.
Whether they had the right to...
I understand the argument in the briefs that they had their own individual claim to damages that should have survived summary judgment.
But the claim was all damages to the money that went into the trust. And that's where the trial court looked at it, said these are damages to the trust because it was for the loss of that money that was in the trust, and for that reason they had a private right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there any time left? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. And this concludes the afternoon session of January 12, 2016 for the Nebraska Court of Appeals. Thank you all.